And now, IMRO's 2023 Best Local or Regional News Programme, The Voice of the Northwest, the 9 till noon show with Greg Hughes.
And you're very welcome back to the programme. Good morning if you're only after joining us. Lots to come over the next couple of hours, so don't go anywhere. Let's get some of your comments before we take the bingo numbers. I know you're keen to get them if you're playing because it is jackpot day. The bank says that they will not send you a text, but a friend got a text to say that their account had been hacked. You panic because you don't think it's legit, but it was. How can you tell what's real and what's not? Well, if I got a text like that, firstly, I wouldn't be clicking any link within the text, but I would contact the bank straight away, is what I would do. So, and in fairness to the banks that I've dealt with, if it's a case of fraud and you call the fraud number, they do answer really quite quickly, so you can get it sorted ASAP, I would hope. Another big red flag is if paying a deposit. Don't use friends and family on PayPal. If person is asking to use friends and family, don't do it. Really, really good advice. You will see that sometimes. It means that you've got no recourse against that person. So there are protections built into PayPal in case you are defrauded. But if you click friends and family to someone you don't know or don't trust, then you lose those protections. One of the few advantages of PayPal. Hi, Greg. I got this message from Messenger yesterday from someone I know asking for my phone number. I did send my number and then they asked me for a code but didn't go into it. Thank God. That comes in from Seamus. Seamus, I got a ton of these messages. Go on, send me your phone number. Phrased not quite like that, but not dissimilar. So you're right too. And I started wondering when I got the first one, I was like, well, what could this be about? And then I got two or three and then the penny dropped. These cases are all down to greed, says the listener. I know I did this one day, a caller said. I had a business account and one day while working flat out, the bank sent a message. I know now it wasn't the bank, but I clicked the link and said yes and almost lost €60,000. The bank were very helpful in sorting me, but only with the grace of God because they stopped it before it went out of the account. I would urge people to take a minute and think regardless of the pressure you're under. Such good advice. And there is a window with certain banks and certain types of payment where it can show that it's been deducted from your account. I think it's called a ghost payment or something along those lines. And there is a short window of time sometimes whereby that can be reversed. A caller says she was in A&E last week and was treated very well. However, the process for people who are checking in at reception is ridiculous. People's personal details are being shouted out for everyone to hear and there's no privacy. It is not the staff's fault, but an administration issue where management don't allow a facility for staff to gain information privately. And with all the stuff that we talk about, some of these facilities, it's the little things that you think that a difference could be made on. And we did get a commitment on this programme that the manager, Sean Murphy, the general manager, would have a look at that. Because obviously there's big stuff that's going to take years to fix and some might feel they may never be fixed. But little things you would hope that could be resolved really quite quickly. But unfortunately, that hasn't happened yet. Just listening to you talk about government paying for pet accommodation for refugees, have they really lost the plot? Could it be true to say the country had gone to the dogs? Well, they're not doing it as much anymore, but it was true. There's no doubt about that. Morning, Greg. I watched a programme on Virgin One TV last night called Ireland is Full. A man called Nick Henderson said migrants who came with no passport documents were assessed within 2 days. Fingerprints taken and all information about them found out. This is not true. The government are treating us, the Irish people, like fools. Thank you. Well, the reality is if you listen to Helen McEntee talking about why Ireland needs to sign up to this new migration pact, it was to actually mean that if we fingerprint someone, we know where they've come from, what their history or background is if they arrived in another country. So it's crazy in that it's been denied that that was a problem, but now we're being told by government to fix the problem that initially wasn't a problem. The EU Migration Pact is how we do it. You can understand why people get a little bit cynical. Are we not a sovereign republic? And therefore, why does Helen McEntee, Minister for Justice, need to say we need to sign up to the new EU pact on migration or immigration? Are we not in control of our own borders and can we not enforce our own decisions? This is a derogation of responsibility. Clearly, when our politicians don't want to do as we, the voters, want, they invent the excuse to blame the EU. Immigration, farming, high oil prices, etc. The electorate are not falling for this anymore. They are awake. Eyes wide open. The eyes were never closed, I would argue. But I take your point. And lastly, on a different note, just before we take a break, we've got Lord William Hay joining us, actually, in studio for a chat. So if you have any questions for William Hay, get them into us right now, 086 60 24 60 25000. We were talking to about phrases that annoy people. This phrase drives me crazy: at the end of the day. Yeah, at the end of the day is often used. Greg, on the annoying phrase issue, one that has crept in recent years is, do you know what? Okay. I don't know where it came from, but now otherwise sensible people are running about you know-whatting all over the place. Another one is the overuse of the word like. Some people can't string a sentence together without having about five likes in it. I know what you're saying, like, because sometimes like it's hard to say a sentence like without like in it. Another is, I'm not going to lie, you're looking fantastic today. Does that mean they normally would lie? I suppose all these have come from our friends in the USA. Keep the phrases and the words that annoy you coming into us, some of them so far, at the end of the day. Another one is, do you know what? The overuse of the word like. And also, I'm not going to lie to you, those are some that annoy so far. Keep them coming into us as well. Just, I find that entertaining. It's nice to mix it in with some of the serious stuff we talk about, and then, of course, some less serious stuff. Right, Lord William Hay, joining us after we take this quick break. Okay, you're very welcome back to the 9 till noon show, and I'm very pleased to welcome into studio with me Lord William Hay, politician with the DUP. Good morning to you. Thank you so much for your time today. Good morning. How are you keeping?
We're doing all right.
Okay. Now, you are a Donegal man, are you? Or how do yes. you describe yourself?
Well, I describe myself as, I suppose, in many ways, being British.
Yes.
Very much so. Although I was born in Milford, Kilmacrannan. Moved to Northern Ireland when I was about 3, and I suppose the rest is history.
And where does your Britishness come from, if that makes sense?
Well, I suppose for many people living in Northern Ireland and who want to retain their Britishness, as opposed to look to Britain, they look to Westminster, they look to what Westminster can deliver for them, but most of all, they are very proud and want to be British. Whether they were born and wherever they were born, I think they still want to retain their Britishness in so many, many ways.
One of the battles you had was in obtaining a British passport.
Well, that was a difficult one, not only for me, but for about, it affects something very close to my own heart,
yeah.
But it affects about 40,000 people who were born in the Irish Republic, who now live in Northern Ireland. And I'm talking about people who have lived in Northern Ireland for many, many years, who've paid their taxes, who've paid their national insurance, and who have voted in various elections and find a real difficulty in applying for a British passport. And remember, if you look at the Good Friday Agreement, it talked about party of esteem. You can designate yourself as British, Irish or other. These people can't do that, except to pay a huge fee of £1,500 to be designated as a British citizenship with no guarantee of then getting a British passport. British citizenship only gives you the right to apply for a British passport. It doesn't come automatically to you. So for many, many people, and I suppose this was an issue that probably should have been sorted during the negotiations, both in the Good Friday Agreement and at St Andrews. Unfortunately, it wasn't. But we now have hopefully a resolution to it, with the British government feeling that this needs to be addressed. And my colleague Gavin Robertson, who's now the interim leader of the party, he has a bill in through the House of Commons. It has set its second reading, and the government is now going to support that bill, although it will remain a private member's bill. And hopefully this anomaly now once and for all can be settled, because this goes back to 2005.
Do you think it was really more of an oversight then?
Well, I think it was more or less an oversight, because I was able to secure debate in the House of Lords and on it, I suppose, a number of months ago. And every political party, Labour, Lib Dems, crossbenches, was saying this is a monopoly that needs to be fixed. So there is support in Westminster and from the British government to resolve this issue once and for all. I think they didn't realise that it was affecting in around 40,000 people when it was indicated at the last census in 2001.
We may have come back to that, but you've been in politics now for half a century. It goes back to 1981, where you were elected into Derry, Londonderry. 30 years in local government. It's a long time. We're not going to pick through that, William, because neither you or I have the time for it. So really, in your own words, how would you reflect on that 3 decades of your political career?
I suppose for me, I worked for a long time behind the scenes of the politics. My mother was first elected to council in 1972-73. I followed her then to council, as you say, in 1981. And for me, I suppose politics has been fairly good to me. I've been lucky in those years. I've never lost an election, where I know many of my colleagues who's worked hard I've lost elections. I haven't done that. I've been very lucky.
What do you put that down to? I mean, obviously, you reference luck. That's a little bit, you know, maybe not giving yourself a little bit of credit there. But why do you think that that the people have continued to back you over those years? Because that's what it takes.
I think for me, it's hard work. Mm. It's representing the constituency. It's probably going the second mile to represent people. And in a national city, in the city of Londonderry, on occasions top the poll at most elections. So for me, it's all about doing the work. And for me, as soon as an election's over, I'm almost campaigning for the next election. Mm. So for me, as I say, politics has been reasonably good to me. I still keep in contact with many, many people across the city. For me, that's very important. I still work with people who would come to me on issues. And for me, it's probably a labour of love. And it's a bit like it gets into your blood, mm-hmm. you know, and you love the cut and thrust. Oh, I love the cut and thrust of politics. And for me, as I say, I've been very, very lucky in those years.
And how would you frame your relationship with the nationalist population of the city?
I would hope that I would have a good relationship with the wider nationalist community. We may have different views politically. But I would have many, many nationalists who I'm friendly with, who come to talk to me about issues. For me, the nationalist community and I have worked reasonably well together on many, many issues.
Now, and we'll move on to where you went from there, but just listening to you talking about the level of commitment to politics over those 30 years and beyond, but we'll get to beyond in a moment. Anyone involved with you, any family members or what have you, partner, they have to take you. There's a third person in the relationship, isn't there? It's politics. You need a big support network that are prepared to buy into your commitment with you.
Well, I think you need that support at home. I couldn't have done the job that I've done over the last 30 years and more without that support. And I know at home, when I was much younger, politics was discussed sometimes on a weekly basis around the dinner table. So for me, I've sort of grown up with the politics. And yes, you need that support at home. You mightn't sometimes get it 100%, but I think if you get 80% of that support, because you're away from home quite often. You know, I'm in London now Monday to Thursday. Normally, I don't go every week, but I go most weeks. So I'm away from home Monday to Thursday. So you need that support at home.
Yeah.
Absolutely, to make politics a success.
But I mean, you know, you can be a lightning rod for abuse and opinion and what have you as a politician. And I suppose as a politician, to some extent, you sign up to that. And that the face of that's changed even since, you know, you were first elected to now. I suppose those around us don't sign up for that necessarily as well, which I presume from your perspective is kind of tough.
Well, it is tough, and you have to know what you're getting yourself into. And you try also to have a private life, which sometimes can be very difficult. And sometimes the public out there don't believe that politicians should have a private life and should have a social life. And occasions, the two can clash. And for me, it's trying to separate the politics into my social life, and sometimes for many, many people that's very difficult. I haven't been too bad. I've been able to do that and do it reasonably successfully.
You then were elected to the local assembly in the late 90s, 1998, and after that then elected Speaker of the Northern Ireland Assembly in 2007. Talk to me about life as a local assembly member.
Well, I was elected in 98, and I suppose as a party we did reasonably well in that election, I have to say. But it was a difficult period, I have to say, because we were elected and some of us weren't used. We were all involved in local government, but you were taking a very higher step into an elected assembly in delivering for the people that elected you. You know, you were looking at committees, you were looking at departments, how would they all work, the appointment of ministers, all of that came into it. So it's a huge, quick learning curve for all of us, even our own party leaders and all of that. So 98, and we've got to remember, in 99, 2000, you had the first minister from the Ulster Unions, David Trimble, and your Seamus Mallon's deputy. The assembly fell in 1999. It fell then in 2000 for a number of reasons. So there was and I think sometimes people think, well, the assembly has only fallen in earlier years. That's not the case. The assembly in 99, 2000 fell for a number of reasons. So it was then trying to get back on track in 2001, 2002. But for me and for many people, it was certainly a huge learning curve. Mm. And we had to do it very quickly.
Yeah, learn on the job.
Exactly.
Well.
And sometimes we didn't always get it right. And sometimes we had to think on the hoof around some of the policies and some of the issues, you know. But for ourselves as a party, you know, we were representing a community that needed to be represented. And for us, that was very, very important. And I think we did that reasonably successfully.
Did you feel you were able to better sort of deliver for those that elected you as an assembly member rather than as a member of the council?
Well, for me, I enjoyed my time in council because you could actually see what you delivered on the ground.
It's a little bit different to the councils in the Republic in that it is more influential. I don't mean that with any disrespect for Donegal County Council, but there are more decisions and more influence you can have as a member of a council in the North, certainly at that time, than you could in the Republic.
And you can see the success of what you have delivered. And it's all about helping people. It's all about taking on board their deep concerns, but then it's delivery, and you see that delivery at local government, where the assembly was sort of a wee bit more difficult because it took a long time to deliver really anything. Mm. Where your local authority was able to make a decision and move on, where the assembly went through a number of hoops before they got to make the decision they needed to make. So certainly for me, local government showed me that you could deliver and deliver very quickly.
How well did you work with those of a different political persuasion to you as member of the local assembly? How well did you work together? Well, or are there people that you never engaged with at all?
Well, those were difficult years, I have to say, because there was no meeting of mind between ourselves and Sinn Féin especially. And I suppose for us, when I look back at 1999 and 2000, David Trimble, who went into government with Sinn Féin on a promise of arms and didn't get it, and jumped out in 2000 again the year later and didn't get what he wanted. We were very clear as a party, and we were clear from day one. We had a number of issues that needed to be addressed. You know, could a party be in government with arms sitting outside the door? Those arms need to be decommissioned. Could a party be in government as a minister and not support policing and law and order, joining the policing board? So there was a number of issues. And we learned from the Ulster Unionists. It couldn't be a promise. Mm. We needed to see delivery in a number of areas, which happened, I have to say. And I know many people at that time says you'll never succeed. It'll never happen. And of course, as well, a pledge of office. As you took up your ministerial position, a pledge of office on law and order and supporting law and order, supporting policing and all of that. So there was a number of issues that needed to be addressed. This is why it took some time for the Assembly to be reformed again.
Yeah. And then you were elevated to Speaker, the longest serving Speaker so far, 7 years. The Assembly did a full term, one full term under you in any case. Was it a tough call? How did you roll in terms of being able to represent the people, which is, you know, what you spent your career up until then do? Are you able to still do that and be the Speaker, or to some extent do you have to step away because of time and other commitments from the on-the-ground stuff and focus more on the role of Speaker? No,
I think for me was the only, I still was very active in the constituency. I think for me was just being careful when you went to a meeting, knowing that the issue might come into the Assembly. Mm. So then you sort of got somewhere else to the meeting to
step
represent
back
you.
A bit, yeah.
You had to step back because you had to demonstrate both in actions and not only actions, but seemed to be totally impartial. And sometimes that wasn't always easy because sometimes your own party created you more problems than any other party. Mm. But I remember when I took up the job of Speaker, I remember saying to the party leaders, look, let us see if we can do a full term. And whatever the issues are, let's see if we can resolve them. I will certainly have a very open door policy. And we were able to do that. In fact, do a full term, go to election, and they did another full term.
Did you form any relationships with those that you didn't think you would during that time?
Well, I did, yes, I have to say I did, and it was interesting.
Anything stand out for you?
Well, I suppose for me, you know, all the parties were through my door on a number of issues. And, you know, for me it was trying to settle them down, trying to meet with them, but trying to listen to them more than anything else and finding a way of dealing with their issue, whether it be Sinn Féin, whether it be the SDLP, whatever party.
But did that change you at all?
It didn't change me in my unionism.
No, I don't doubt that for a moment. But just in terms of, you know, did it change your attitude? Well, maybe this is, we have to do things a little bit differently to get work done.
I think that is right, and get people to think differently to get the business through the Assembly. And to be fair, most parties, of all parties, accommodated the business through the House. And for me, it was to keep difficult arguments out of the House, mm-hmm. if it could be. The issue of the House wasn't really an issue. It was the issues behind the scenes mm-hmm. that you were trying to resolve for whoever you come through your door. And for me, I tell you, as Speaker, I learnt a lot, I have to say, and had a very good team around me as well, who were very effective, and people who were giving me advice. So I was very lucky. I had a very, very strong team around me. And you needed that strong team because there were many issues even within the Assembly that we had to deal with.
Yeah.
Because remember, we were only up and running in 2007. It was formulating departments, formulating standing orders, getting committees up and running, all of that. So all of that took time, and for the Speaker's office, we were extremely busy.
Yeah. I note when I was just doing a little bit of, reading up, we'll pick up your career. Pretty much in every article, regardless of who writes it that you're referred to as Donegal-born William Hay.
Yes, and I've no problem.
Is that great?
With
that. Do you like it?
I've no problem.
I know you're not ashamed of Donegal.
Not at all. I've still some family who live in Donegal, in Milford, Kilmacrenan, where I was born, and in Letterkenny as well. My mother's from Letterkenny, and my father's from Milford, Kilmacrenan. Mm. So I have never hid that.
No, I know that. I'm not saying
an
insult.
And people say to me, yes, I am. Mm. I hold an Irish passport, because I can't have difficulty getting a British passport, you know, and I don't see any issue with that. I would just like a British passport to show my British identity.
Oh, I get that. I understand. What does it mean to someone in your position to be appointed to the House of Lords? That was 2014. That would be under David Cameron's time. How does that come about? Are the feelers put out? Do you lobby for it? Does someone approach you? Does your party put you forward for it? How does that come to pass?
Well, it was the party who put me forward for the House of Lords, and it was David Cameron then who appointed me just before he left office, really. So for me, it was a huge privilege. I sit in the House of Lords and I look around and I say, how did I ever get here? As somebody from Donegal, somebody who has represented the constituency for practically well over 30 years and now sitting in the House of Lords.
And what, how important is the role of those in the House of Lords? Because I think, you know, I mean, people obviously hear there's going to be some with a great interest in British politics, I've no doubt about that, but just sort of maybe see it in a negative light. How important is the House of Lords, do you think, in terms of the running of?
Well, I mean, I've been there from 2014 now. I have saw a House of Lords that has been very effective, especially when bills come from the House of Commons that needs changed and corrected. They're very good at that. Also as well, the House of Lords have huge expertise in the House. And they're very good when it comes to legislation and when it comes to bills from the House of Commons to the House of Lords. And of course, bills can start also in the House of Lords and move to the House of Commons. For example, you know, we have our interim leader, Gavin Robinson, who introduced the bill, private members' bill on British citizenship. That will now come to the House of Lords. I will pick that up and take it through the House of Lords. So. I know sometimes, you know, when people look at the House of Lords on television, they see old men sort of half asleep.
Well, I'm glad it's you saying all this. I tried to skirt around.
But I mean, that's not, I have to say, that's not the case. It's a very active house in so many ways and a very fluent house. They don't really stand on procedures that much. So it's a different house from the House of Commons, a totally different house. And it's not as sharp a house.
Just in relation to the DUP as a party itself, how much of a bolt out of the blue did the Geoffrey Donaldson news come to you? And I suppose, what was your reaction?
Huge shock. I have to say, it went through the entire party and they just could not believe it. You know, the rumour was out on the Thursday when he was arrested. They weren't given any names, 61-year-old man, woman, all of that. And I suppose for leadership of the party was getting clarity around the issue, and then when the names come out, and I have to say the party worked very quickly. Geoffrey Dunham arrested on the Thursday, party met on the Friday, closed ranks and elected Gavin Robinson as the interim leader. And you know, not only a huge shock to the party, but a huge shock to the wider community in Northern Ireland, and also especially to the unionist community, because he's been a high profile politician for many, many years. And you know, we have to be careful what we say around this issue, legally and procedurally, but we've always got to remember there's families involved here. So we be so careful as a party what we have said and what we have said as individuals. You know, but yes, Craig, it was a huge shock. And it still is a shock.
Of course.
I mean, I'm speak to people in the party all of the time. They still can't believe it. Just cannot believe it.
It did seem otherworldly. Like, it was like, well, where's this come from?
Well, that's exactly right. And, you know,
sometimes you hear news and pardon my ignorance if other people suspected this might happen, I don't know. But sometimes you hear stuff, right, and you go, right, well, you were waiting for it. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Do you get where I'm coming from? And then others, it's like, well, where did that come from?
Exactly, and it was like a bolt out of the blue for everybody that weekend. But the party does come together very quickly when we're talking about crisis, and they've done that in the past, and they will do it again. And Gavin, who I know extremely well, Gavin is total support of the party, you know.
And you have to choose your words carefully as well. I mean, there's obviously going to be some a mixture of emotions, but as you've quite rightly says, there are alleged victims here, and one has to be very careful as to, I don't mean you now here,
in
how you respond to something, even if you think that it's untrue.
Aye, and you know, as soon as a DUP politician goes on a radio programme anywhere now, that's almost...
Yeah, well, I purposely
which is right, which is quite right.
Of course,
I mean, that's all
but,
right.
But my interest more is how it affected you as someone obviously incredibly loyal to the party rather than the...
It affected me. I just couldn't believe it. And I would have known Geoffrey fairly well. And I still can hardly take it in that we're in the situation we're in. And yes, as I say, it's not only affected the party, but also I think that wider community as well. We still can't believe it yet.
How comfortable are you with Michelle O'Neill as First Minister?
Well, I think you have to look democratically at the election. And this is what people voted for. And, you know, if we're Democrats, we have to accept it. Mm-hmm. Can't bury our head in the sand and say, well, no, we will not share power because somebody else, another party, has gained supremacy over us. Mm-hmm. That's not the issue at all. The assembly elections are there. That's the result. And we have to try and get on with it and deal with the issues.
Yeah, but it does talk to sort of, you know, an increase in popularity. I mean, the politics of Northern Ireland is changing, even compared to 81 or even compared to 1998. You know, it was always sort of green and orange, but now it's so much different. We see the alliance increasing in population. We see the population demographics changing, you know, not in the way that might have been predicted 30 or 40 years ago. And then, of course, with that, and then with the sort of conversation that's been having about, you know, border polls and unity and unionist place in this new Ireland, as if it is a fait accompli, and it certainly isn't really once we get down to the debates of it all. Do unionists feel squeezed or threatened or unsure about the future? And it's a broad church of many different people with many different feelings. Don't get me wrong, I accept that. But what do you think the overriding sense is amongst unionists?
Well, I am personally a very confident unionist, and I think there are many unionists in Northern Ireland who are confident as well in the future of Northern Ireland staying within the union. And we only have to look at the report over the last few weeks that has come out on the cost that would be if we were trying to bring both parts of the island together. I have no fear whatsoever, and I've heard this argument, you know, nationalism now will soon be in a majority in Northern Ireland, and if that is right, that's the way it's going. But I don't have this belief that because nationalists would be in a majority, that automatically there would be a United Ireland. I think for us, as a party, we need to be focused on delivering and ensuring Northern Ireland stays within the United Kingdom. I think that's our job as the lead unionist party in Northern Ireland. Mm. And key to that is selling the union in a very positive
But do you step. Believe Northern Ireland genuinely, hand on heart, is in a better position and a better position going forward as part of the union? Obviously, you know, it would be like dragging a family member out of a family. You might see it as that, you know, why would you want to do that? But do you not think there would be a better future of the people you represent as part of United Ireland, as part of the EU?
No, I believe very much in the union between Northern Ireland and the rest of this United Kingdom. And certainly for us as a party, we are now very focused on that, ensuring Northern Ireland stays within the union. I don't hear or see anything or anybody or any party coming forward that has convinced unionism that they should join a united Ireland.
Is one of the biggest challenges, though, really, is how much Britain wants Northern Ireland? Or, like, I think the general population are a bit nonplussed. We kind of saw the Conservatives, to get Brexit over the line, they wouldn't mind sort of casting Northern Ireland off. You know, and I just, according to one poll of Conservative members, is part of the really biggest fight is to try and prove to London and the wider British public that Northern Ireland's place is in the union and that that's where it should be. You know what I mean?
Yes, but I speak to Conservative MPs, members of the House of Lords, even Labour members, and I have to say they are very supportive of Northern Ireland staying within the union. Now, some of us could take that at face value and say, are they serious? You only can take somebody at their word. And I think for ourselves as a party, and I keep saying this, we need to do more to sell the positives of the union. And they're huge positives. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you only look what financial help we get from Westminster, huge financial help. Now, we would argue that we don't get enough. I think under the Barnett formula, we don't. And the British government now have agreed with the Treasury that Northern Ireland needs to be funded in a different way, on need, same as Scotland and Wales.
Ironically, that could bring down the cost of reunification.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I have to say that people who are advocating unity will never convince unionists that they should be in United Ireland.
You're born in Donegal, moved to Northern Ireland, so I won't hold you any longer. Do you ever hear from unionists or members of the Orange Order, and I'm not saying both are the same necessarily, from Donegal, other parts of Ireland, that feel isolated here, that they have to sort of hide their identity, or that they don't feel they can discuss their political, ideological beliefs or celebrate their orangism? Is that even a word? I don't know. But down where I live, I know there are families that are unionist families, and if you went into the house, it would be very clear, but it's almost as if that's a secret life. Not, you know what I mean? I'm not overstating
it. I know.
Is there anything that needs to be done in the Republic that people feel they can be who they are more publicly?
I think that the government here could do more to identify with unionists in the Republic of Ireland, especially around that East Donegal area and region. Absolutely. Now, I do know that the Orange in East Donegal is very successful in so many ways. And I know they've got grants for doing up their Orange Halls and all of them. And all that's very welcome. But yes, there would be unionists, and I think there would be a majority, who feel sometimes they just have to keep their head down. They don't have really anybody to vote for either. I think most of them would maybe vote just Fine Gael or something. I'm not too sure. But yes, I would speak to them and they would say, yes, sort of head down here now. Let's not create too many problems. Now, I deal with politicians across the border, and I deal with them very successfully. So for me, the border is not an obstacle in dealing with constituency work. Mm. But I do feel that unionists here, especially in the Republic, do feel sometimes they just can't express themselves the way maybe they should on different issues.
And finally, you were on the record in the past saying that you suffered a health scare.
Yes.
And I think it was your wife's intervention, really, that perhaps gave you the outcome that we have. I think in one interview you sort of referenced that maybe you put your political life before your health or made those decisions. I'm just wondering if that is the case. Have you struck a better work-life balance now?
I have. The speakership was a very, very intense job. You know, you were keeping so many balls up in the air. You were trying to make sure the work in the house was going all right and the business in the house. But you were also doing a lot of work outside the chamber. And yes, it did have its toll on me, health-wise, absolutely. You know, I was doing long hours from, you know, maybe 9 o'clock in the morning right through to very late at night. So it does take your toll. And I have learned my lesson to slow down and not take too much on.
Okay. Listen, it's been lovely having you in. Thank you very much. We've talked about it from time to time. This is the first time we were able to sort of make it work. So we do appreciate it. Lord William Hay, politician with the DUP, of course, member of the House of Lords. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Ray.
I really enjoyed that. Thank you. Now, some sunny spells this morning with rain developing later in the afternoon. Highest temperatures 13 to 6 degrees, degrees with a light to moderate southerly wind, occasionally fresh. Cloudy tonight with rain and drizzle. Lowest temperatures of 10 or 11 degrees, so it is going to feel really quite mild tonight. Thanks again to Lord William Hay for coming in for a conversation. Any reaction to that? 08660 25000. Now, I was just informed that the peaceful death has taken place of James McLean, who was a campaigner on disabilities and a frequent contributor to our morning show, be it the 9 till noon show or the Sean Doherty show previously. So very sad to learn of his passing. He passed away yesterday at Letterkenny University Hospital of Mahara Boy Letterkenny, deeply missed by his loving wife Anne, sons Alan and wife Lisa, Stuart and wife Claire, Mountaintop Letterkenny, and daughter Louise and husband David McGee, grandchildren DJ, Keelan, Kiva, Eve and Noah, brothers Frank and John, sisters Rosemary and Sandra, uncles, nieces, nephews, and a wide circle of family and friends. And we offer our deepest sympathies to all of those people and those affected by James' passing. May he rest in peace.